I'll let you loose on the experiment soon. I don't have all that much to say today, but I do want to say a few things. One is that this is the first week of three lab weeks that you're going to be doing something you have to write up as a report. So I tell you that you're done with points for the day after you've done the quiz because you don't hand things in. Well, that's true technically, but today's stuff you'll also be graded on when you eventually turn in the report, which should be open on Canvas by today. I think I set it to not open until today so you wouldn't be confused earlier. I don't have memorized what the due date is. You should check that on Canvas, though. This important thing to say about that at this point, though, because you're not writing your report immediately. You know, all you're doing is getting your data from here. You, of course, will have identical data within your group. Two or three working together will have the same data. But importantly, every student writes an individualized report. You're not turning in the same report as someone else. You do these individually. But anyway, once you get your numbers today, which doesn't take all that long, you're done here, and you can, not forget about it, but just make sure that you get it in by the due date, whatever that is on Canvas. As far as what you do, though, it's like I said before, it's not a typical format for a lab report, a formal lab report. It's really just a matter of going through the things that are on the page in your handout that you got last time, one of which is instructions for how to write the report. Yeah, the page 6 of 10, lab report directions. You're just doing that. Right? You can just write one and put the answer and so on. It's not a formal report. But also importantly, regardless of what it might say in here, because this was written by an instructor for a different section, the one who wrote the manual originally. Regardless of what it says in there, do not give me any hard copy of a report. These are submitted only via Canvas and only as DocX format. So if you hate Word, that's your own business, but every student has free access to it, so you don't have the excuse of saying, I don't have it. Use Word to make the report. You will have a graph in there. Pay attention to this. You're submitting one thing. So the graph that you produce, the image of that, whether it's a snapshot of a hand-drawn graph or a computer-generated graph image, you insert that into the document and submit just the Word document. All right? Don't give me separate. Submit, I don't think Canvas will even let you, but don't do that, I'm telling you. Everyone clear on that? All right, now, as far as the graph is concerned, and I'll talk more about graphing in a minute, I will leave it up to you whether you want to do a hand-drawn graph or a computer-generated graph, as long as it includes all the things that a graph should include. We have, or certain instructors have in the past, required you to do it by hand. I won't absolutely require you to do it by hand as long as you are able to do a graph by hand. And you should consider that to be a hint. What I'm saying is that you eventually will need to be able to do a hand-drawn graph in here. So if you never have done that, maybe you want to do it a hand-drawn graph. But if you've done graphs before and you're fine with using a computer-generated graph, that is also fine. Just make sure you insert it into the Word document either way, snapshot or insert an image. All right, now that brings us to the actual science or the important concepts for today, one of which is careful liquid measurement, which we are kind of using today and other weeks. There's a lot of different times you need to carefully measure liquids. And you have various containers sitting out today. including beakers, which are the ones that don't taper. These are Erlenmeyer flasks. And these are graduated cylinders of various sizes. Now, notice that all three of those things have graduations on them. They show volume tick marks. But for careful measurement, you should never use a beaker or a flask. Those are just rough indications to let you know kind of how much you have. Those are for containing things and conducting tests in. The careful measurement of liquids should always be done with a graduated cylinder, or if it's too small to use a graduated cylinder, you would use a pipette of some sort or a micropipetter. And speaking of graduated cylinders, they come in different sizes, and the appropriate one to use is the smallest one that is big enough to do the job in one measurement. You know, if you're measuring an amount that the smallest one can't hold, you could use it, but you'd have to do it in several different measurements, right? And each of those measurements has some error associated with it, so they could add up. Instead, it's better to make one measurement using the smallest one that's big enough to do the job. But you don't want to use one that's enormous. I mean, this is why graduated cylinders are used instead of beakers or Erlenmeyer flasks for careful measurement, because they are relatively narrow cylinders. If you have a volume of water and you pour it into a sheet pan, the level's not going to change much at all, right? But if you pour that same volume into a narrow column, it's going to change greatly vertically. It's going to spread out. And if you make a change in that volume, it's going to be a big vertical change, giving you plenty of room to give a lot of tick marks, which means scientifically you have greater resolution, as we talked about last time, right? So that's why you use the smallest one to do the job. Okay. Let me also repeat, since we're using these definitions today, what I've told you in lab as far as mixtures in which things are dissolved are concerned. The three definitions that I've already given you, and hopefully you remember, are solution, solute, and solvent. Right? A solution is a particular type of a mixture in which one thing is dissolved in another thing. The solution is the overall mixture. The solute is the thing that's dissolved by the other thing, and the thing that does the dissolving is the solvent. And there doesn't have to be just one solute or one solvent. It can be multiple ones in one solution. Speaking of solutions, though, what are your solutions today? What kind of solutions are they? Salt water, and specifically what salt? Sodium chloride, which is table salt to most people. What values of concentration are you using? Yes, 0, 1, 3, and 5. Capital M stands for molar, which is just one of multiple ways that you can measure concentrations. A concentration of a solution refers to how much solute there is in that mixture for a given volume of it, for instance. And you can define that, you know, just like any other quantity, you have choices for your units. Length can be, you can use many different units. Same with concentration. The capital M, though, is one unit, which is molar. The symbol is capital M, but you pronounce that as molar. Molarity is the measurement of concentration that we're using for this lab and in this whole term. It's not the only one, though. It's defined, though, as moles of solute per liter of overall solution. And so, yes, you're using 0, 1, 3, and 5 molar solutions. Those are sitting over here, by the way. These are where you get your various saltwater mixtures. If you're the first to pour it, it's good to invert it a couple times before you do that. But they're labeled here, so just make sure that your containers are also labeled and you put the right stuff into the right container so that you get proper data. What does the zero molar sodium chloride contain? Just water, yeah. Zero molar means there's no solute. But this is 1, 3, and 5. To give you an idea how much salt is in each of those, these are liter bottles. So if you have 1 liter overall, this much salt is, this is a mole of sodium chloride, so there's this much salt dissolved in it. 3 moles and 5 moles. Okay? But you don't, that's just to show you how much salt there's in it. You don't open those up and use that salt. All right, now, it's pretty easy to obtain these data. That's why it goes pretty quick. But there are a few ways you can mess it up. One of which is by not carefully making temperature measurements. You have little temperature thermometers that you can use. Make sure they're set to centigrade if there is a choice. But the way you mess that up is to just put the thermometer in the container and let it like it is in there. Just sitting on the bottom of the glass. You don't want to have the metal of the thermometer touching the sides or the bottom of the glassware. It's going to give you a false reading. So make sure it's well submerged, the tip, but only in the liquid. And let it stabilize. You know, if you first put it in there, that number is not correct yet. You have to let it stabilize for a couple seconds. But you don't want to let it stabilize forever either, because things can change. That brings up another way, an easier way to mess up. What you're measuring today is boiling point, which is the temperature at which boiling occurs. And so that brings up the question of what boiling is. Well, it depends on who's looking at the solution, kind of. I mean, do you define boiling as the very first tiny bubble that emerges? Or a full roaring boil, or somewhere in between. There's a range, right? Well, you want your measurement to be made at the same level of boiling for all of your different solutions. So before you start the experiment, get together as a group and determine what you're going to say is boiling. Try not to make it a full raging boil, you know, a little bit before that, but Not that first tiny bubble either. But whatever it is, define what it is and stick to that definition, and for all of your solutions, get that temperature at that same degree of boiling. Alright, you don't want that to vary much. Another way you can mess up is in letting it boil too long. Now, if you have pure water, which you do for one of your solutions, and if you had a device to continuously log the temperature as time goes by, creating a graph, you would start below boiling point, of course, and the temperature would rise steadily, right, as you continue to add heat. But when you get to the boiling point, whatever it is, and I say whatever it is because it's not necessarily 100. Don't expect it to be 100. 100 is the boiling point for water under standard pressure, 1 atmosphere. We're not at sea level, so it's not going to be 100. But anyway, when you get to the boiling point, you're going to continue giving it heat, but the temperature is going to stay steady at that boiling point, and it's just going to evaporate more and more water, creating more and more steam. If you were collecting that steam, eventually there will be no liquid water left, all steam, and if you kept heating it, then the steam would get hotter. But until there's all the liquid's gone, the liquid stays at boiling point. And so therefore, this one would be easy to not mess up, because you could take that temperature anywhere in that range. It's not changing. But all your other solutions have salt in them, right? Well, if a salt water solution starts to boil, it's not all of the components of that solution that are evaporating. Only the solvent is, only the water. Right? Water is the solvent in this solution. There's really two solutes. You're using a compound, right? Sodium chloride. But when you put it into water, as we discussed in lecture, it's no longer sodium chloride. It's individual sodium ions and individual chloride ions in solution. So you really have two solutes. But anyway, they're the solutes. Water is the solvent. And only the water evaporates when it's boiling. Which is why if you put on a pot of boiling salt water and forget about it or fall asleep, 2 hours later, it's a dry pan with salt, dry salt in the bottom. The salt didn't go anywhere, all the water did. The point here is that if you let a salt water solution boil, which is supposed to be at a certain concentration, right? 0, 1, 3, and 5. If you let it boil, you're removing water, but keeping the same amount of salt behind, right? What happens to the concentration then? If you're removing water in the form of water vapor. Right, it gets more concentrated, gets saltier, and therefore you've messed up the experiment because you want your concentration to stay at what it was. That's why you need to define a boiling point scenario and get that temperature right then before it loses much more water. Alright, so do all of that to get good results. Just make sure everyone involved in the group has a copy of all your data before you leave. Now, the next major point I want to talk about are variables, scientific variables in experiments. Any given experiment features variables. Variables just exist in the universe. They're anything that can vary in value, right? So there's all kinds of things about the universe that are changing all the time. But in an experiment, you don't want things that can vary but don't have anything to do with the experiment to affect the experiment. Therefore, as a scientist, you want to, or you're trying to control the variables, keep them from varying, the ones that don't have anything to do with the experiment. And that's why we call that category of variables controlled variables. You're actually trying to make them constant, not variable, because you don't want them to in any way affect the outcome of the experiment. Then there's the other two major categories, independent variables and dependent variables. And these two get confused all the time by people. You can think about them linguistically, but I think it's better to learn them practically, meaning based on how they're used. So the dependent variable in any given experiment is the thing that you as the scientist measure in that experiment. Think of it that way. Right? Whereas the independent variable is the thing that you as the scientist adjust from one subject in the experiment to the next, like your different solutions, right? So what's the dependent variable in your experiment today?
Water.
No. Temperature. Boiling point specifically. The temperature at which boiling occurs. Right? That's what you're measuring. And what about the independent variable? The molarity of the solution, exactly. That's what you're adjusting intentionally. And everything else you're trying to keep the same. Let me just give you a made-up example of another experiment to illustrate these. If I were doing an experiment to test the effect, if any, that concentration of a nutrient solution has on the growth rate of a plant, there's all kinds of things that could interfere with that I don't want, right? So those are the controlled variables. For instance, I would want to use just one species of plant for all of my subjects. They should all be the same age and in good health to start with. They should all be given the same amount of water, same amount of sunlight, same temperature. Those are all controlled variables. They have nothing to do with the experiment, so you don't want them to affect the results. You do that by keeping them the same for all of your subjects. In that experiment that I just described, what is the independent variable? No, that's a controlled variable. What did I just say? In general, is the independent variable. Can't hear you. What I adjust? What am I adjusting in this plant experiment? What about the nutrients? I'm not adjusting the type of nutrient, for instance. The concentration of the nutrient solution is what I'm adjusting. So that's the independent variable. What's the dependent variable? The growth rate of the plant. That's what I'm directly measuring, right? You measure the dependent variable, you adjust the independent variable. Linguistically, we call the dependent variable dependent because it's possible, although not necessary, that the dependent variable, the thing we measure, actually depends on the value of the independent variable. That's the whole idea of going through with the test itself. The test, the experiment, tries to determine whether the dependent variable actually does depend on the independent variable. But that's why it's called dependent. And we call it dependent whether it actually does depend or not. All right? And you don't know that until after you've done the experiment. This brings us to graphing. It's not the only way to portray data, but typically results are graphed because you get a lot of information at a quick glance in a graph. It has a lot of information in it. That's one reason. But of those three categories of variables that we just talked about, which category is not on the graph? The controlled variables. You're trying to make those, in essence, not exist, right? So any properly constructed two-dimensional scientific graph includes independent variable and dependent variable only. Well, a two-dimensional graph has a horizontal axis and a vertical axis. One variable type goes somewhere and the other one goes the other axis, but there's a right way and a wrong way to do it, right? Which is the vertical axis variable. What goes here on the y-axis? Which one? No, the dependent. Always the dependent variable on your y-axis. Always independent variable on the x-axis. This is analogous to a mathematical function, right? Mathematical function is like an imaginary box that you input something into as an x value. It does something to it and pops out a y value, right? Similarly, your input for your experiment is what you adjust. Like in this plant experiment, the concentration of nutrient solution. And so I would label that, right? Concentration, I would write it out, but I'm just being quick here. Concentration of nutrient solution, and I wouldn't leave it as just words, right? Because there's different kinds of concentration. You can't put numbers to this unless you actually have units, right? So put the name of the variable and in parentheses the units, which we could use as molar, for instance, in my plant experiment. That's in essence my input. I'm adjusting that in the experiment. And then I take a measurement, which is the output of, in this case, growth rate, which I could define any way I wanted to. Let's just say millimeters per week. You know, I'm directly measuring that. That's why it's the dependent variable. And so, you know, I get data, real data, that I plot for however many values of x, however many concentrations I test for, right? Each one has a growth rate corresponding to it. Well, these are not perfectly collinear points. And that's because real data have a little bit of error associated with them. So even if it is a perfectly linear relationship, real data will very rarely be perfectly linear. But if it looks like it's not just coincidence that it's like that, it looks like a trend, then you're justified in fitting a line of best fit. And importantly, a line of best fit does not necessarily go through any real data point. A line of best fit is the line that gets as close as possible to as many as possible of those points. Might go through them in the process, it might not go through any. A computer will do it for you automatically. You can do it by hand, though, and this is where a transparent ruler comes in handy, because if you use an opaque ruler, you're going to cover some of the points when you try to draw the line. But, you know, this one looks like it'd be about like that. Well, in this case, that's a horizontal line, right? And what does that tell you about the dependence of the dependent variable on the independent variable? Mathematically, what does that tell you about y depending on x? It tells you that it does not depend on it. Y is always the same value, right? For any given x, y is the same value if it's a horizontal line. So yes, we would still call this the dependent variable because that's what we measured, but our results tell us that actually this variable does not depend on this variable. Because you can make it whatever you want, you always get the same value. All right? Which, you know, that would be valuable information scientifically, but it rarely happens that there's no dependence, because that has to be just right, right? That's a special case. Usually there's dependence one way or the other, though. And it doesn't have to be a linear relationship, but often it is. It just depends on the variables. All right, so let's just say I have points that look like this. You know, I could fit a line to those that look like that. That is a dependence. But it's also a dependence if it slants down to the right. It's just in opposite directions. It still depends on the independent variable's value. All right, now, one reason you make this trend line or line of best fit is simply to make it easier to look at. When you read the graph to see whether there's dependence at all. But even more importantly, a well-fitted line, properly fitted, is a valuable tool. It is a measuring device, in a sense, used for prediction. Now, these are the real data. And I say these because data is a plural word. So it's these data, not that data. Anyway, only the points were truly measured, right? Those are the raw data. And for yours, for your experiment, you're going to have 4 points, right? Because you measure boiling point at 4 different concentrations. But even though you only measure so many values, it might be interesting to consider what the values of the dependent variable would be for other values that you didn't measure at of the independent variable. That's what a trend line allows you to do predictions for. And so this process of using a trend line for prediction of values that aren't actually measured comes in 2 varieties, which are really different names for the same process. But there is interpolation and extrapolation. Both of them really are the same process, but what does inter mean? Like in international? It means between. Intra means within. Inter means between. And extra means what? Outside of. It's the opposite of intra. Extraterrestrial, outside of Earth. Okay, so it's the same process of using the line in both cases, but it's important to distinguish these two. Interpolation uses the trend line to make a prediction. For any value of x, or the independent variable, between the lowest one that you used and the highest one that you used. So anywhere in this range would be interpolation if I'm using the trend line. Extrapolation is using it beyond either too low or too high, beyond the range that you actually measured at. And the reason we give them different names, even though it's the same process, is because they are scientifically different with respect to trusting those predictions. You want to actually avoid extrapolation if you can in science. Interpolation is much safer. Now, just using this plant example, it looks like there's a definite relationship, a positive relationship between growth rate and concentration of nutrient solution, meaning that the higher the concentration of nutrient solution, the greater the growth rate. But if you extrapolate, you're going to assume that continues forever. Well, if you actually bothered to make it stronger and stronger, maybe too strong finally kills the plant. An extrapolation would say, okay, it's really up here, when in fact it's down here. That's why extrapolation should be avoided. It's extrapolation on this end, too, if you get below the lowest one that you actually measured. Whereas if you stay within your overall range, it's likely that it's going to be a safer bet. Using the trend line itself, though, is an easy matter graphically. You can do it mathematically if you know the equation of the line, which a computer will give you. But you can also do it with a hand-drawn graph, just graphically. For instance, if you want to know what the growth rate would be if you used this concentration, this value of x, which you didn't actually test at, you simply go straight up to the trend line and then straight over to the y-axis and read that value. That's what the trend line predicts the growth rate to be for this value of concentration of nutrient solution. Does that make sense? Okay, that's why we do that. So this is not a proper graph for multiple reasons. One is that, so I'm telling you this because you should give me a proper graph when you make one for the report. A proper graph, first of all, has a title. This one doesn't. And there are good titles and there are terrible titles. An example of a terrible title for this experiment's graph would be Last Thursday's Lab. That is a terrible title. But I see stuff like that all the time. Or Bio 181. That has nothing to do with the experiment, right? The title should actually describe what the graph is depicting. So for instance, this one could be The Effect of Nutrient Solution Concentration on Growth Rate. It's one way to describe it. It says what it says. Now, you don't have to use the word versus, but we use that often. I just want you to realize that there's only one way to properly do it, and the author of this might have gotten this wrong, so beware of that, if it's even in there at all. But if you use the word versus, it's always dependent versus independent, never the other way around. So I would not be allowed to call this concentration of nutrient solution versus growth rate. That's backwards. It's growth rate versus concentration of nutrient solution. You don't have to use versus. I just say if you do, use it correctly. All right, so make sure you have a good descriptive title. Make sure your axes are labeled the way I've shown you here. You have a label in words and then in parentheses the units for both X and Y. But you also have to label the axes with tick marks, right? Here's another common error I see. You're using 0, 1, 3, and 5 molar concentrations, right? I can almost guarantee that some of you will give me a graph with 0, 1, 3, 5. This is not a proper number line, right? Think back to kindergarten. There's more space between 1 and 3 than 0 and 1, so don't equally space these out. That would be appropriate if you had a categoric axis, like yellow, red, and orange, you know, which aren't in a particular order. These are numbers. This is a numerical axis. So go from whatever low number to whatever high number that is enough to for your range, but put them in the right positions, the ones that you actually measured. And speaking of the range, set up both of your axes correctly, appropriately, meaning don't give me a graph like, if this is the page, that's not a good graph. Set up your axes so you use the space available. Figure out what the whole range of your x values are and go from a little bit below the smallest to a little bit above the highest so you can spread them out horizontally and do the same for the vertical. You don't have to start at zero. Right, if you make several measurements and they're all between 990,000 and a million, you wouldn't go from zero to a million. All your dots would be up here. You spread it out. You don't have to start at zero. And you shouldn't on this one, right? Because you're not going to be close to zero in your temperatures. They're all going to be 90 and above. So you might want to start at 90 instead. That way you get a nice spread out graph and you can tell the difference easily between the data, the individual points. Any questions on all that? Okay, well, like I said, one more thing I forgot to tell you is that when you're doing this boiling, first of all, since it's boiling, as soon as I shut up, before you start, you need to get goggles on and keep them on today. They're over there. Also, though, before you start, before you deliver any of your liquid into your flasks, put two or three of these glass beads in each flask to use as boiling chips. That will disallow it from uncontrollably boiling, which can burn you easily. But don't put any of these glass beads down the sink, which is why the bucket's here and the strainer. So when you're done and you pour out your salt solution, just pour them through here. If the bucket fills, then empty just the bucket, but make sure the glass beads stay. Now, I know I had one other thing I wanted to say. What was that? I guess I already said it. Just, you know, don't think that you have to get through this whole packet, which is all about writing the report. You're doing that on your own time. Just get good data and make sure everyone has all the numbers, and then you're done. It probably won't take you as long as I've just talked, so go ahead and get started.